Okay, Psalm 26, another one of the Psalms of David. Of course, in the King James, he says, "Judge me, O Eternal." And, of course, the word judge means more than we take it to mean in English, because it means, judge me so you'd vindicate me, so you'd do me justice. So by judging me, you're going to see that I've been striving to go your way, and then I'll be vindicated, or then you can do me justice. I've walked in mine integrity. I've trusted also in the Eternal, so I'll not slide. Examine me, O Eternal, and prove me. Try my reins and my heart. Of course, this applies to both your thoughts and your deep feelings. So it applies to both our mind and our gut feelings, or the depths of our being. For your loving kindness is before mine eyes, and I have walked in your truth. And of course, the word walked suggests habitually. I have walked and do walk and continue to walk. So it's a habitual terminology and not just a past tense. Then he goes back to the first psalm in thinking, I have not sat with vain persons, neither will I go in with dissemblers. So again, the warning of how you begin to get into trouble. You stand and then you sit, and that's how you get tempted and get in trouble. So he says, I haven't sat with vain persons. So here, in a sense, is an individual disfellowshipment, where if you recognize people are bad for you by the conversation they have, or their goals, what their reins and their heart is, then you stay away from them. So individuals, as well as the church, when it gets real severe, have to disfellowship. So you can't allow yourself to sit with vain persons. They're always talking about nothing of God and nothing that's permanent. Neither will I go in with dissemblers. So you have to stay away from troublemakers, or people that cause division, or people that are always causing you to lose faith and lose confidence. I have hated the congregation of evildoers. So you notice then you avoid being around people that are always assembling or congregating and creating mischief or error or wickedness or evil. So once you recognize the influence it can have on you, then you can hate the assembling or the gathering together and talking of evildoers, and will not sit with the wicked. And here the word is the word Rasha, the lawless. Stay away from rebels. Stay away from people that are above the law, that are always independent Christians, that aren't under authority. They don't know what it is to be conquered. They're not governed. So he warns about not sitting with the rebels and hating the congregation of evildoers. I will wash mine hands in innocency, so will I compass thine altar, O Eternal. So when you come before God, you have to come before God with an innocency, because you've avoided the temptations of the surroundings, that I may publish with the voice of thanksgiving, and tell of all thy wondrous works. Eternal, I have loved the habitation of your house. So now he's contrasting how he hated the congregation of evildoers, and yet now he loves the habitation of God's house, and the place where God's honor dwells, where God puts his name, where God has chosen for his temple. Gather not my soul with sinners, nor my life with bloody men. So now he's saying, I avoid the congregating of evildoers. I don't sit with vain persons. I don't go in with the dissemblers. I don't sit with the wicked. So don't punish punish me with them. Don't gather my soul together with them and have the same thing happen to me that happens with them. Don't gather my soul with sinners, nor my life with men of blood. In other words, I shouldn't have to shed blood, or you shouldn't punish me along with sinners because I've avoided their assembly and their company, in whose hands is mischief, and their right hand is full of bribes. The word mischief is otherwise translated lewdness. So it isn't just a practical jokes he's talking about there, or trivia, mischief, but lewdness. But as for me, I'll walk in mine integrity. So that's why he said in verse 1, judge me, search me, examine me. I'll walk in mine integrity, redeem me, and be full of mercy to me. So at the same time that you can ask God to examine you or judge you, you still have to fall back on His mercy and redemption, as David does there in verse 11. So even though you can say, well, now, God, I'm striving to avoid the wrong influence, and I'm striving to love your habitation and your people and your house, but you'll just have to be merciful to me and redeem me when I don't succeed, but I'm trying to walk in mine integrity. My foot stands in an even place in the congregation. I'll bless the Eternal. Of course, he's contrasting a slippery place up above. If you're walking with the wicked and setting with the vain, then your foot doesn't stand in an even place. It's uneven, and you're going to trip and fall and slip and fall. But if you're standing in the congregations, then your foot stands in an even place. It's safe and secure, and you won't be slipping. And now, Psalm 27, another one of the Psalms of David. The Eternal is my light and my salvation. One thing you might want to do in a way of a review, going back through the Psalms we've covered so far, would be to make a list of the titles of God, which is quite interesting. Then maybe when you're praying sometime, if you have a 3x5 card with all these, God is my light, my rock, my redeemer, my shield, my high tower, my salvation, you know, and you get all those names in mind. Of course, in the Hebrew, they're a compound word, Yahweh Rofika, God our healer, and same way as here. You'd find these compound words, the Eternal my light, the Eternal my salvation. Then whom shall I fear? The Eternal is the strength of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? Now, David didn't always believe that, and he didn't always know that, as you're going to see a little later when we get over into the 30s, that David learned the hard way when he numbered Israel, and when he counted, trusted in his own strength. That was one of the great lessons he had to learn, that God is your strength, and God is the light and the salvation of your life. And if you trust in that, then you don't have any reason to be afraid. But sure as you start trusting in yourself, you're going to see a little later one of the Psalms where David said, I began to feel secure and I began to feel confident, and all of a sudden, you might notice Psalm 30, verse 6, we'll come over there a little later, but David says, in my prosperity, I said, I'll never be moved. And this is what he said after he numbered Israel, as we'll tie the chapter in Samuel in with this 30th Psalm. But David began to trust in the strength that he saw with his own eye, and then he found out that isn't where you have the trust. In my prosperity, I said, I'll never be moved. Eternal, by your favor, you've made my mountain to stand strong. You did hide your face, and I was troubled. So he had learned the hard way that when you go to trusting in your own strength, you're doomed to fall. So here he's quoting the lesson he learned in chapter 27, or Psalm 27. The Eternal is my light and my salvation. As long as that's the case, then who should you fear? And of course, the obvious answer is you don't have to fear anybody if that's the truth. Now, in this particular psalm, you'll notice two divisions that stand out from one another. The first six verses is a language of triumph, praising God, longing for God's house. And then the last, verses 7 through 14, are a prayer from the midst of his enemies. So you'll notice first he states his lesson, and then he shows the trouble he was in earlier. When the wicked, mine enemies and my foes, came upon me to eat my flesh. So here God likens human persecutors to animals, like the book of Daniel does human governments. So human enemies can be like national enemies, likened to animals. They came upon me to eat my flesh, they stumbled and fell. So when God is your light and your salvation, supernatural things occur. I was reading one of the monthly reports from one of the church areas, I guess it was yesterday, and one of the men mentioned that a carload of young people were driving down a mountain from an activity they'd had, and their brakes went out. And the young person kept running his car into the side of the mountain to try to keep slowing it down. And finally it slowed down a little bit, but then it went head over, back over the front, turned over two times and landed on its wheels, and stopped right at the edge of the cliff. So they were rejoicing in the miracle, the way God intervened and delivered them. And it'd be interesting sometime to ask down in the auditorium how many people never have had a miracle happen in their lives. Mr. Armstrong was mentioning last Sabbath, about angels grabbing their automobile at least two times. So God always works miracles. And here David had his enemies, his foes, the wicked, trying to devour him like a bunch of wild animals. And God intervened and they stumbled and fell. So he says, though an host should encamp against me, my heart shall not fear. So he'd learned by experience that it didn't make any difference about numbers or how ferocious somebody was. God was always there. Though war should rise against me, in this I'll be confident. One thing I've desired of the Eternal, that I'll seek after, that I may dwell in the house of the Eternal all the days of my life. Now, of course, here's a golden scripture. It's one, perhaps, that you should memorize as one thing that you always desire of the Eternal, that you may dwell in the house of the Eternal all the days of your life, to behold the beauty of the Eternal, and to inquire in His temple. So it's talking about a holy day there, of course. That's the only time you dwell in the house of the Eternal, during the feast seasons. For in the time of trouble, He shall hide me in His tent, in His tabernacle. In the secret of His tabernacle, He'll hide me. He shall set me up upon a rock. Now, for some weird reason, I've got Petra written in my Bible there. And I didn't erase it, I hadn't scratched through it and put 1974. There's still an inspired margin there with a possibility. Now, it doesn't have to be Petra, but at least that's a reminder that there is a place of safety. Both words here are the same. The word pavilion and tabernacle are one and the same. Why they double talk that way, I don't know. But in the time of trouble, God shelters you under His wings. But in this case, it isn't just talking about sheltered under His wings. It's being hid in His tabernacle. Now, a tabernacle is just a temporary dwelling. It doesn't mean a temple, or it doesn't mean a dome of a rock or anything else. It just means a temporary dwelling. Your body is a tabernacle. In the secret of His tabernacle, He'll hide me. He'll set me upon a rock. Now, here it very definitely ties in being hid, being in the secret place, being hid, set upon a rock. So almost anyone would think of a place of hiding in a cave or in a rocky group of mountains that compass you about. Now shall mine head be lifted up above mine enemies round about me. Therefore will I offer in his tabernacle sacrifice of joy. Now, of course, here again is another holy day verse, showing once God delivered David from his enemies and he was back up above them again and over them, then he went in and showed his respects to God because God's the one that did it. Therefore, I'll offer in his tabernacle sacrifices of joy. And the word is shouting there, not just happiness or a mild term for joy. I will sing, yea, I'll sing praises unto the Eternal. Hear, O Eternal, when I cry with my voice, have mercy also upon me, and answer me. When you said, seek you my face, my heart said to you, let my face seek your face. Hide not your face from me. Put not your servant away in anger. Now, I remember years ago, Dr. Hay gave a sermon on why does God hide himself? And, of course, this shows that God is of too pure eyes to behold evil. So there are times in our life God just turns his face away from us and hides his face from us. And then God beseeches us to seek his face. And then if our attitude is like David's and we repent and admit where we're wrong, then we say, my heart said to you, let my face seek your face. And then he asked God not to hide his face from him and not to put his servant away in anger. You've been my help. Leave me not, neither forsake me, O God of my salvation. When my father and my mother forsake me, then the Eternal will take me up. Now, you know, King Saul had a decree out that anybody that sheltered a criminal or anybody that protected him or gave him refuge or food or anything else would be chopped in bits. And so even the father and the mother didn't dare have any protection or any help. And you'll see a little later that applied to his whole family, any of his relatives. It didn't mean they hated David or that he was such a type person that they just didn't want to have anything to do with. But it all was because of this decree of Saul that if anybody gave shelter to the criminal, then they'd be dealt with as well. So when my father and my mother forsake me, then the Eternal will take me up. Teach me your way, O Eternal, and lead me in a plain path because of mine enemies. Don't deliver me over to the will of mine enemies, because false witnesses are risen up against me, and such as breathe out cruelty. So they didn't hesitate to slander, misrepresent, or hire people to say wrong things. Now, I don't know why we aren't smart enough to know that the devil would do the same thing in our day, you know. A lot of the accusations that are thrown around against different people, you know, you can't believe that any more than you could believe what they said against David in David's day, or what the false witnesses said against Christ in Christ's day. And yet I read a letter from one of the ex-students down in Big Sandy, and he was making a comment that, you know, anybody that thought Mr. Armstrong and some of the leaders of our day were going to be some of the great men in the world tomorrow, they were going to have a rude awakening between now and Christ's second coming. Of course, he's out of the church and following somebody else, and I'm afraid he's going to be the one that's going to have a rude awakening. But, you know, it's always been the case all the way through the Scriptures. As David says here, false witnesses are risen up against me, and such as breathe out cruelty. Now, Mr. Armstrong has always had the practice of not answering accusations. You know, when he has newspapers call and they want to ask for an interview and this and that and the other, he never does offer. He never does give them an interview. I had fainted unless I had believed to see the goodness of the Eternal in the land of the living. In other words, his only endurance through this persecution of his enemies was thinking about, surely God's going to deliver me again. surely God isn't through with me. So I'm just going to keep on believing that through these dark clouds, the goodness of the eternal is going to, I'm going to behold it still in the land of the living. He's not going to let me die. So even against false witnesses, against all of the rejection of his family, he still asked God to teach him his way and to keep leading him in a plain path. And then he summarizes his lesson in verse 14. Wait on the eternal. Be of good courage. He'll strengthen your heart. Wait, I say, on the eternal. Now, that's one great lesson you always learn. I don't know how many times I thought sure our kids were going to die. You can't tell by a sound, you know, and maybe one of our daughters had a real bad respiratory condition, and I heard her quit breathing a couple of times, and that just scares the liver out of you, you know. It just really frightens you to no end. But you just keep saying, well, you know, God gave them to you, and their life's in God's hands anyway, so if God's going to allow them to die, you know, that's God's business, and you just keep waiting on God, and he never did, you know. None of them ever did. In fact, the one that had the respiratory trouble by the time she got to be a teenager could whip any of the boys in her grade and all of her sisters, even the ones who are older than she was. But he just says, you know, after he summarizes the first part of the psalm, rejoicing and praising and celebrating, and then he explains all the trouble he was in the last half of the psalm, and then he summarizes it, verse 14, wait on the eternal. Just maintain a good courage. Be persistent. Stick to it. Hang in there. Don't give up. And God will strengthen your heart. Now, there are two different terms here. The good courage is commitment on our part. Being determined, stick-to-itiveness, and then God intervenes and gives the power. You've got to have the commitment, and God has the power. So there are two opposite words there. Wait, I say, on the eternal. Now, in the Psalm 28, here's one of the Psalms toward the end of David's life, and Psalm 27 and 28 are actually twin psalms. They pretty much say the same thing again. You notice how, unto you will I cry, O eternal my rock. Now that's quite a common statement in the psalms. David many times will start out with a positive statement like that, saying, you know, you're my rock, I look to you, you're my strength, and I cry to you. And then he goes back and tells you the trouble that he had. So these two probably were put back to back because of their similarity. And here again, the same thing. There are two parts of this psalm. One relating the prayer of joy and hope and praise. And then the other telling about the trouble that he was in. So notice how this one fits right in with Psalm 27. Unto you I'll cry, O eternal, my rock. Now, there are several words for rock, and I don't think I gave those to you before. You might notice Psalm 18. Selah is one of them. There are several different words. Notice Psalm 18. The eternal is my rock and my fortress, and my deliverer. Now, the first word, rock, here is the word Selah, which literally means a rock fortress or a rock seclusion. Now, the next word, my fortress, literally means a mountain stronghold. It's more of a military term for being encamped in a mountain stronghold. Mezudah is the Hebrew word, M-E-Z-U-D-A-H. Now, there's another word for rock that just means a high place. Zur, that means a pinnacle or a high place. So, the Selah rock is a fortress, like a cave in Petra. But the whole Petra Valley is more the Mizuda, a mountain stronghold. So you'll find different words used. In this case here, the word is Zur, here in Psalm 28. Unto you I'll cry, O Eternal, my Zur, Z-U-R. You're my high rock or my pinnacle of a rock. Don't be silent to me. Lest if you be silent to me, if you're quiet and don't answer and don't respond, I become like them that go down into the pit. Now, there's several words for pit. You know, the Bible isn't consistent in the King James Version. Sometimes the word pit is literally the word Sheol. Other times the word pit is, like this word here, is the word for sepulcher. Bor, B-O-R. So it's a hewn-out sepulcher. So this isn't talking about Sheol, but a literal sepulcher. So he's saying, if you maintain a silence, God, then I'm going to be buried in a sepulcher. And yet you're supposed to be my rock that's a pinnacle, a high tower, a stronghold, and not allow me to be buried in another rock, a sepulcher rock. So he's contrasting God as your rock, your protector, your fortress, compared to the rock of the grave. Hear the voice of my supplications when I cry unto you. When I lift up mine hands toward your holy oracle, draw me not away with the wicked. Here again the words Rasha the lawless, and with the workers of iniquity, which speak peace to their neighbors, but evil. Now here, the word mischief here is rea, evil or wicked. Wickedness is in their hearts. Evil's in their hearts. And yet they speak peace to their neighbors, and yet they have evil in mind. So don't draw me away with those rebels, the lawless, with these workers of iniquity. Now, of course, the word iniquity, there's the word Avon, which is your nature, your evil in your nature. So, in a way, he's going back to what he said earlier, where he said, I don't sit with the wicked, and I don't stand with the evil, and I don't dwell among them. So now he's asking God to draw him not away in a sense of punishing him with the wicked and the ones with iniquity. Give them according to their deeds, according to the wickedness of their endeavors. Give them after the work of their hands. Render to them their desert. Now, in this particular passage, the wordage is not vengeance on David's part. Here he's just saying a certain amount of injustice has to be dealt with, God, or other people suffer without any cause. So he's asking God for justice. He's asking God to halt the wicked so others don't suffer. He's not saying, get them, God, you know, I'd just like to stand here and watch you really give it to them, you know. He's appealing to God for the sake of the innocent who suffer by being drawn in with these wicked. So you don't find any terminologies of vengeance, and as you do in a few passages where God lets David's human nature show through in the writing of some of the Psalms. Now you notice the contrast here in verse 5, because they regard not the deeds of the Eternal. Now that's the same word exactly as deeds in verse 4. So David is saying, since they won't regard the deeds of the Eternal, since they persist in performing their own deeds, then give them according to their deeds. Let them reap what they're sowing. But God intervene and help the innocent not to have to suffer with them. Because they don't regard the deeds of the Eternal, nor the operation of His hands, He shall destroy them and not build them up. Blessed or happy, you know, the same word means both, blessed and happy, be ye the Eternal. Because He has heard the voice of my supplications, Now, when you read the word supplications, you need to always remember that it's a stronger word than just prayer. It's a term that means persistent prayer about one specific thing habitually. So if there's a particular thing you pray about every day, and then maybe even you fast about from time to time, that's what a supplication is. So it's really the strongest form of prayer. You're showing God how serious you are about something and how much something means to you because you pray about it every day, even with fasting. So here he isn't just saying, God heard my sleepy time prayer or God heard my passing prayer. No, God heard the voice of my supplications. The Eternal is my strength and my shield. So here again are some more names of God or relationships God has to you, your strength, your shield. My heart trusted in Him, had confidence in Him, and I'm helped. Therefore, my heart greatly rejoices, and with my song, I'll praise Him. The Eternal is their strength, and He is the saving strength of His anointed. So now, he's passing on the same fact to God's people. He says, the Eternal is my strength, and now he's saying, the Eternal is Israel's strength, the nation, the people that are chosen by God, as well as the individual, the king that was chosen by God. He is the saving strength of His anointed. Now, of course, this doesn't just mean the people of Israel, but it's also the Messiah. Now, of course, no Jews would ever admit that, but that doesn't change the fact. The same as the nation of Israel was God's chosen people, the same way Christ is the anointed. And the emphasis here is on God. He is the saving strength of His anointed. Save your people and bless your inheritance. So that shows you their strength in verse 8, talking about God's people. Save your people. The Eternal is their strength. Bless your inheritance. Feed them also and lift them up forever. So instead of giving the wicked according to their deeds, he asked God to lift them up, his people, and feed them. And the word feed here is the same as tending sheep, feeding sheep. So he's likening the people once again of God to the sheep back in Psalm 23. And there's really a continual tie-in in these Psalms in the 20s. If you took one of them out of the context and used it all by itself, you know, Psalm 22 is a messianic psalm, and Psalm 23 is about the shepherd, and then Psalm 25 is alphabetized, but these all tie right in one after the other and tie in together. Now, in Psalm 29, there's a lot in this psalm that you might not get just by scanning down through the verses, but we'll do that and then come back. When he says, give unto the Eternal, O you mighty, the word give here is more ascribe or render, bring as due, pay back. It's due, it's something you owe. It's not just saying, in your goodness give. You know, you don't give tithe, you pay tithe. Jesus said, render unto God the things that are God's. You notice? The tithe always belonged to God. Dr. Hayes emphasized that again and again in the refresher program. You know, the tithe was always given to God, and then God gave it to the Levite. Now, you might take it and give it to the Levite, but when you did, you were giving it to God, and then God gave it to the Levite. It wasn't your gift to the Levite. He didn't owe you anything because you gave it to him. You gave it to God in your heart and mind and your thinking, and then God gave it to the Levite. Well, later God gave it to Melchizedek, as he had done before. So the term give here doesn't mean out of the goodness of your heart or out of the worship of your righteousness. No, it means pay back what's due. When you think about render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's. Now think about what that's saying. They came and asked him, you know, about paying tribute, and he said, well, let's see whose picture's on there. Well, if his picture's on there, it must belong to him. How'd he get his picture on there if it isn't his? Then you give back to him what belongs to him. And then he said, you render unto God the things that are God's. And yet nobody ever uses that verse when they try to disprove tithing or second-guess tithing, and yet that's one of the best scriptures in the Bible. You ought to read that. Render unto God the things that are God's. How do you know what things are God's? Well, he has to tell you somewhere else. And then you don't give it. You pay back. You render it unto God. So here he's saying, ascribe to God. Pay back to God. You owe God, so give it to God. Give unto the eternal, O you mighty. And that word's probably talking about angels rather than humans. Give unto the eternal glory and strength. Of course, it just means you're recognizing His glory and strength, and you're admitting it and confessing it, and you're ascribing it to God. Give unto the eternal the glory due unto His name. Now, David's trying to teach himself that he hadn't always done that. You know, that he trusted in himself and trusted in his power and trusted in his numbers of peoples. And now he's having to admit that you better just always give God the credit. Acknowledge God as the strength. Give unto the eternal the glory due unto His name. Worship the eternal in the beauty of holiness. Now, the word worship literally means bow down. Admit your incapability in God's power. Bow down. So even the very word worship shows you can't come before God with worship in your own goodness or your own self-righteousness. The only way you can worship the eternal by the definition of the word is bow down. Admit your inability. Admit your need and your failing and your shortcoming and your strengthlessness. Worship the eternal in the beauty of holiness. Now, when I read this, I can read it like a Baptist, because I was one of them for 28 years. Or not 28, but 21 years. And you know, we'd read that and we'd just say, boy, that's what we Baptists are doing. We're worshiping the eternal. Isn't that beautiful, seeing all the Baptists go to the building and sing and hear the 12-minute sermon, and you know, we're worshiping the eternal. We're beautiful doing it. Now, that ain't what that's talking about at all. It says, bow down in His glorious sanctuary. The beauty of His sanctuary. You're not doing it in the beauty of holiness. The place where God's presence is the beauty of holiness. God's presence there makes it holy. So it's the beauty of God's presence, the beauty of holiness, that you come before God humbly and you bow down before God in His presence of holiness. And boy, look what the opposite it means in Protestant terminology. Now he comes back to more of the reason man should ascribe to God the greatness. The voice of the eternal is upon the waters. Now, notice verse 10. The eternal sits upon the flood. So this is going way back to the time of the flood in Genesis and showing that it was God's voice that decreed the waters to come out of the underground and come out of the heavens up above the firmament. The voice of the eternal is what brought all the flood waters. So that doesn't mean God is just standing out there yelling across the ocean or something. The voice of the eternal decreed the flood waters. It was the power over it that brought it. The God of glory, and here the word God is El, the mighty creator, El, the God of glory. Now, the God of glory, that means He dwells in glory. He's a glorified being. He has glory to give to people when they become sons of God. Doesn't just mean God's way is glorious, but that's the way Protestants spiritualize it away. You know, it's just a cotton candy nonsense that you hear that kind of talk in a Protestant church, which I heard for 20 years, the God of glory. Isn't God's way glorious? You know, isn't it glorious to be a Christian and go to Sunday school and go to church on Sunday and He's the God of glory? That's all that ever meant. Now, that didn't mean a shining, bright being that would blind your eyes to see Him. But that's what it is here. The L of glory thunders. And how many times you hear people talk about the sweet voice of Jesus, you know, and the L of glory thunders. The eternal is upon many waters, mighty waters. The Red Sea that was divided, and the crash that came back with God's Word, the dividing of the Jordan, the flood. The voice of the eternal is powerful. The voice of the eternal is full of majesty. The voice of the eternal breaks the cedars. Yea, the eternal breaks the cedars of Lebanon. Now he's likening God's voice to a storm that's moving across Palestine. And it comes out of the mountains on the north, up at Mount Hermon, and sweeps all the way down through Palestine, all the way to the south. So what he's describing here is a storm passing from the north to the south, and David sees in that God's voice. And God's power and might and strength and majesty. And so the many waters that pour down and the thunder, the lightning and everything, why else would he break the cedars? Lightning strikes them and breaks them. He breaks the cedars of Lebanon. He makes them also to skip like a calf. Maybe that's a gale of wind blowing, so the trees just look like they're hopping along like a calf. Maybe it's a bit of an earthquake that's putting a ripple there that makes these trees skip like a calf. Lebanon and Hermon like a young unicorn. So now he's zeroing in on Lebanon and Mount Hermon and how they're affected by God's presence and this storm sweeping through like a young rhinoceros. Now, unicorn is kind of interesting to read about. You know, the people that translated the Bible, they didn't believe in dinosaurs, so they talk about Leviathan and Behemoth. You know, one of them's a crocodile and the other one's a hippopotamus. And that's absolutely ridiculous. You know, God's talking about dinosaurs. And here, a unicorn, they'll say, well, that's a young water buffalo, or some people say that's a, you know, all kinds of animals, wild pig or whatever. Well, it might be talking about some kind of a dinosaur earlier, but it's probably just talking about a rhinoceros. Because there are scriptures that show you can't tame one of them. And if you can ever hook one up to a plow, then you can tell God you can change the nature He put in creatures. But so far, you've never seen anybody hook a rhinoceros up to a plow. In fact, God says if you try it, you'll remember that and you'll never forget it. That always struck me when I'd tour the museum in Chicago and read what they had to say in there about the rhinoceros. And, of course, you see it in a movie, you know, where John Wayne tries to tame a rhinoceros. And, you know, the thing doesn't have sense enough not to butt his truck and knock his truck over and attack metal equipment like that. But here God is glorified in power as being able to make skip like a young unicorn. The voice of the eternal divides the flames of fire. Now, causes fire to go out into tongues is more what he's saying here. Cleaves with flames of fire. It's similar to the term on Pentecost where cloven tongues stood over each one's head. Similar term here in the Hebrew. The voice of the eternal shakes the wilderness, either with a storm moving through, tornado, hurricane. The eternal shakes the wilderness of Kadesh. The voice of the eternal makes the hinds to calve.
So the old saying about not frightening somebody when they're close to delivery comes out of the Bible. Now, whether it's true of humans or not, I don't know. But it works with animals. It's biblical. It's not a science fiction comment. The sound of thunder and the sound of God's tornado and hurricane and a storm would actually, by fright, cause animals ready to deliver to deliver. And discovers the forest. Now, when the leaves all fall off, you discover the forest. You strip them naked, or you know, when you discover someone's lewdness, you took their clothes off, as it showed back in the Old Testament. So when God discovers the forest, it means the hail just beats all the leaves off the trees, and the wind blows all the leaves off the trees, and you can see the whole forest. There's no coverage. And in his temple, this isn't the word for, this is the word for palace. In God's heavens, God's palace up in the heavens, does everyone speak of his glory? The four living creatures and the 24 elders and all the cherubs and seraphs. And so up there in God's palace, all of those spirit beings speaks of his glory. The Eternal sits upon the flood. Yea, the Eternal sits king forever. So that has to be talking about when he's going to come back in this glorified presence. The Eternal will give strength unto his people. The Eternal will bless his people with peace. So you always notice after it talks about him sitting king, that's after he's returned. So I write Advent across that verse. And then you know it's talking about Christ's second coming. You can write 1,000 across it if you want. It's about the millennium. When God gives strength back to his people, Israel, and when God blesses his people with the millennium, 1,000 years of peace. Now, Psalm 30, here you get a new title, a double title actually. You have both the word Mizmor, the word for psalm, and the word for song, Shir, S-H-I-R. So for the first time we run onto the word. Now, this word Shire means a common song, and the word Mizmor, the word for psalm, is never used except of the sacred song. So what he's saying here is that this is both a sacred and a common song. It's not just strictly for singing in church or for a choir to perform on a holy day or a Sabbath. It's also a common song as well as a religious, a spiritual song. So he uses both names at the dedication of the house of God, of David rather. So this is tied in with 2 Samuel 7. You might notice that. 2 Samuel 7, verses 1 and 2. It came to pass when the king sat in his house, and the Eternal had given him rest round about from all of his enemies, the king said unto Nathan the prophet, "See now, I dwell in the house of cedar, but the ark of God dwells within curtains." So this isn't talking about the temple on Moriah, but it's a psalm for dedication of any house. You know, it may well be for an altar that David built on Mount Moriah when he first purchased a part of Mount Moriah. 2 Samuel chapter 5, you can read about that if you want to. I don't think we'll turn there and take the time to. So, you know, if you wanted to have a psalm at the dedication of your new home, you could use Psalm 30. It's not limited to consecrated holy buildings. Because if it did, it'd only have the word Mizmor at the top of it, and it doesn't. It has the other word as well, for common song, sure. So, the dedication of the house. Now, here, "I will extol you, O Eternal, for you have lifted me up." A terminology of being brought up out of the pit. You've brought me up out of the pit. You've lifted me up. "You haven't made my foes to rejoice over me." So here again, David always knew it was up to God as to whether he won or lost. "O Eternal my God, I cried unto you, and you have healed me." So now you begin to realize why he was downtrodden and dejected. As a matter of fact, we'll read a little later how God had smitten them with a plague at the time, back in Samuel, and David said, well, we better consecrate an altar and offer to God, maybe he'll heal us of this plague and take away this ailment on us. So they built an altar and consecrated it and offered on it, and God took away the plague. So this ties in real well with that, showing that the difficulty he had was he needed to be healed. Now, you can't always force the word healing to apply to physical ailment. It might mean you can be healed as a king by being restored to your throne. You can be healed as a nation by having God's blessing and prosperity come back on you. So how do you know which it is? Well, just keep reading and it'll tell you. What does he mean? You healed me spiritually by putting me back as king when Absalom overthrew me. You healed me by bringing me back to my capital after I was driven out. O Eternal, you have brought up my soul from the grave. So now you see what his trouble was. He was in danger of dying. If God hadn't intervened, he would have been buried in the sepulcher. Now, the word grave here is the word Sheol. You brought up my soul from Sheol. So you notice your Sheol doesn't go to heaven when you die and your body go to the grave. You don't get that out of the Bible. Your nephesh goes to Sheol, not just your body. And that's all the way through the New Testament as well, you know. The soul wasn't buried in the grave only, but the nephesh as well. So here he says, you have brought up my nephesh from Sheol. You have kept me alive that I should not go down to the pit. Now here's the word for sepulcher again, bor. So it's translated well even. Genesis 21 verse 19, even a well in the ground is called a pit. So the word doesn't just mean for burial. Sing unto the Eternal, O you saints of His, and give thanks at the remembrance of His holiness. For His anger endures but a moment. In His favor is life. In fact, that's a little bit, it'd be better translated if they said, for a moment is His anger, but for a lifetime is His favor. So it's contrasting how God gets angry, all right. But thankfully, God's anger is short-lived, you know. It's just for a moment. But God's favor is long-lasting. His favor lasts a lifetime. Weeping may endure for a night when God's anger is upon you and you're ill and you're threatened with the pit and the Sheol. Weeping may endure for a night, but joy comes in the morning. And what was the reason for his smiting? You know, why did God have to strike him down? And he was near the Sheol with his nephesh, and, well, now he'll tell you. In my prosperity, I said, I shall never be moved. So he had a false confidence. He was trusting in numbers and strength and his capital and security. In my prosperity, I said, I shall never be moved. Eternal, by your favor, you've made my mountain to stand strong. So this was Zion that David had just recently taken, 2 Samuel 5, verses 7 through 10. You did hide your face. So once God had made David's mountain stand strong, then David had this false security that I'll never be moved. You know, I've got it made now. You know, God gave me this strong city and we've got great numbers, so we've got it made. And then all of a sudden God had to hide his face because of that attitude of David. So now God turned his face away and hid his face from David, and David was troubled. And that's not the half of it. That word trouble is far, far more powerful than just to say troubled. I mean, he was perplexed and vexed and terrified and worried and afraid and everything. One thing I didn't mention you might want to jot down, back up in the Psalm 29, where it talked about the voice of the Eternal, 7 times he repeats that, bringing out that perfection number again, the number of completeness. And okay, let's go on here then, in verse 8. I cried to you, O Eternal, and unto the Eternal I made supplication. So, it wasn't good enough just to cry to the Eternal now. God had seen in David a tendency to trust in security and trust in numbers and trust in his mountain that God had made stand strong. And now God saw something in David that had to get rooted out. So even when David cried to the Eternal, he didn't hear him. So he had to get even stronger and made supplication unto the Eternal. So now he says, what profit is there in my... Can you believe the word blood is the word soul? What profit is there in my soul when I go down to the pit? And here's another word they translate pit. Shaketh, S-H-A-C-H-A-T-H, literally means destruction or corruption. So what he's saying is, what profit is there in my soul if I go into destruction and corruption? So here he's thinking back about how he'd almost gone too far, and God was about, or at least David thought God was about to let him be buried in Sheol and go to corruption and destruction. And so now he's saying, then where would I have any profit? That would have been the end of me for good. Shall the dust praise you? So once you're in the pit, you're buried in the dust. Shall it be declare your truth? Hear, O Eternal, have mercy upon me. Eternal, you be my helper. So now he's realized he trusted in numbers and men, and now he's repenting and saying, that's right, I forgot that, God. You've got to be my helper. So you just have to have mercy upon me again. And you know, God just causes David to ride in where you can just live his changes of heart, his anguish and his humanity, and then his repentance and trust in God. And the book of Psalms is a book of heart. The very innermost feelings of the coming king. Hear, O Eternal, and have mercy upon me. Eternal, you be my helper. You've turned for me my mourning into dancing. It's kind of interesting to read that in some of the Protestant translations. In fact, maybe I should... Here they say in the Whedon commentary, this shouldn't be taken literally. I mean, don't think that means literally dancing now. You just be in a... This is not to be taken literally. Dancing here is poetical, of joy, or shouts of joy, thanksgiving, and songs. Of course, what does the word mean? Well, they didn't bother to tell you. They didn't want to tell you that. You know, if you looked up the word dancing, you'd find out the very word requires to take it literally. Because some words for dance have to do with circling about. Others have to do with other types of dancing. So you've turned for me my mourning into dancing. You've put off my sackcloth, and you've girded me with gladness, to the end that my glory may sing praise to you and not be silent. So now he's going back to how he asked God not to be silent. So now after he's learned his lesson, God is letting him know, now don't you be silent. You utter the praise, and you let everybody know that if they trust in God and He's their strength, then it's going to work out. But you get self-confident and down you go. Pride comes before a fall. You know, the wisest man who ever lived said. So anytime you find yourself getting puffed up and getting the big head, you might as well get ready, because you know sure as the world what's ahead. And then you're going to eat crow and you're going to be grumbling in the dust. that man never seems to learn that proverb. So here he says, that my glory may sing praise to you and not be silent. O eternal my God, I'll give thanks to you forever. I'm never going to forget this time, God. I'm going to give thanks to you forever. I'm not going to be silent. I ask you not to be silent. Now, let me never be silent. Let me just give thanks to you forever. Now, Psalm 31, another psalm of David. Of course, Psalm 30 even has at the bottom, that's a subscription to the chief musician. That belongs on Psalm 30, showing again that it was one that was composed to be sung, and not just religiously. It's got more than just a lesson in religion. It's a common song as well. So it's for the chief musician. Now he goes on Psalm 31, a psalm of David. In you, O Eternal, do I put my trust. Now here the Hebrew word is flee for refuge again. But notice how many times David starts off that way. He always starts off on a positive note, and then tells you his troubles, and then tells you how he learned the hard way, and then he comes back on a positive note. So almost every psalm, Psalm 30, I'll extol you, O Eternal, because you've lifted me up. And then he tells you how he'd fallen down. He was about dead, and he needed to be healed, and he was about to be buried, and to go to corruption and decay. And so he starts off with the victory comment, and then he tells you what the battle was. And he does that over and over. Psalm 28, he said, unto you I'll cry, O Eternal, my rock. Don't you be silent to me. In you, O Eternal, do I put my trust. In you I flee for refuge. So let me never be ashamed. Deliver me in your righteousness now, not mine, God. I don't want justice. You know, I want grace and mercy and long-suffering. And since David never does ask like Job did, that, you know, I'll challenge God, and I demand justice. Now he says, you'll have to deliver me, God, in your righteousness. I don't think I've ever said verse 2. Maybe I've never had the guts to say that to God. Bow down your ear to me. You know, to me, that's real foreign to our world today, to say, God, are you awake up there? You know, get your ear over there, you know. Are you listening, God? But how many times you find that in the Bible? Bow down your ear to me. Deliver me speedily. Now maybe you can say it when it's just about too late, you know. So here it was just about too late. And if God hadn't intervened quickly, he'd have been long gone in this psalm. So he dares to ask God to do it speedily. Be you my strong rock, Zur, for an house of defense. Now, if he'd used the other rock, word for rock, he'd have meant it by itself without having to have that added phrase on there, for an house of defense to save me. And now he comes back and says, for you are my Selah, you are my rock, my fortress rock, and you're my mountain fortress, my mountain seclusion and protection. So here you have all three words right in the same verses. You're my high tower, my high rock, my peak that I can look to and have protection from. And you're my rock cave, my rock shelter. And you're also my mountain fastness, my mountain fortress. So there you have all three of them right together. Therefore, for your name's sake, lead me and guide me. And, of course, the word lead even here suggests gently. Gently lead me and guide me. Pull me out of the net that they've laid secretly for me. So, here again, he's going to tell you about what a mess he was in. First, he tells you he cried out to God and God delivered him. And then he gives you the mess he was in. So, maybe that's a good way to pray, you know, when you start praying. Always start off with remembering God always delivers you. And then look back and remember the messes you were in. And then end up with how he delivered you. But that's the pattern David always followed. So now he says, pull me out of the net that they've laid secretly for me. For you are my strength, and you is the emphasized word there. Now, in a context like this, talking about rock fortress, mountain fortress, talking about leading me for your name's sake and guiding me and pulling me out of the net, and you're my strength, comes the last words of Jesus in Luke 23:46, into your hand I commit my spirit. And you'd be surprised how many men down through time have said that. Along with Father forgive them, they don't know what they're doing. But many people have quoted this same thing. John Huss, when he was being dealt with, quoted this very same line, into your hand I commit my spirit. Now, he probably didn't know what it meant, but Christ certainly did. So the spirit in man goes back to God that gave it. That's the permanent record of what you are and what you've made in your life, what you've done. Into your hand I commit my right to live again. I commit my spirit in man that's a record of me. God is going to keep that and put it in that spirit body when you're born of God. You have redeemed me, O eternal God of truth. And here are the two names of God. The word G-O-D is El again. E-L. And eternal is, of course, the four-letter God, Y-H-V-H. You have redeemed me. Just means delivered by power. So it doesn't by itself mean spiritual redemption. It means delivered by power. Peta in the Hebrew language, but it can mean either way. I will be glad and rejoice in your mercy because you've considered my trouble. You've known my soul in adversities. So now David says, God, you remember how I've reacted in the past when I went through these things? You've remembered my soul in adversities. You know good and well I'm just going to sit here and wait on you, so you might as well come on. You know, I've done it and done it and done it, and I'm going to do it again now. So notice how he reminds God of how he's reacted in the past to God's trials. You have considered my trouble. You have known my soul in adversities and have not shut me up into the hand of the enemy. You have set my feet in a large room. So apparently they were trying to enclose David in a small prison and restrain him and restrict him from going about, and God delivered him and freed him and let him go as he would, wander where he pleased. Have mercy upon me, O Eternal, for I'm in trouble. Mine eye is consumed with grief, my soul and my belly. Now here he divides up three parts of you that have anguish when you're in trouble. It's in your head, and your eyes shed a lot of tears. Of course, it's in your belly. That's your emotions, your gut feelings. And it's in your soul, your very hope of life, your very desire to live, and your very essence of living. So he divides up the three parts of man that anguish there when he's in deep trouble. For my life is spent with grief, and my years with sighing. My strength fails because of mine iniquity, and my bones are consumed. Now, in this case, in some extreme context, the word iniquity can mean humiliation and not sin, not error. And that's probably what he's talking about here. David's eye consumed with grief. His bones consumed. So here he's probably just talking about the deep humiliation he'd gone through. I was a reproach among all mine enemies, but especially among my neighbors, and a fear to mine acquaintance. So here you notice again the kin folks were afraid to give him any help because, it had been their neck then, and You might jot down this parallel scripture in 2 Samuel 6, verses 16 and 20. He talks there also about among his neighbors and the fear to his acquaintance. In fact, they even composed a sad warning song about, you better not give David any help or you'll live to regret it. They that did see me without fled from me. So kinfolks even wouldn't even allow themselves to be seen with David out of fear of what might happen to them. I'm forgotten as a dead man out of memory. People have been so afraid to be seen with me or deal with me, I'm forgotten as if I'm dead and out of mind. I'm like not just a broken vessel, but a missing vessel. I've become like a missing vessel. Nobody even knows I'm gone. I've heard the slander of many. So, you know, it's kind of a thing about human nature. When somebody's down, then everything about someone that can be taken two ways, it'll always be taken against them. You know, if there's someone that's gotten in bad with you, then everything that comes up that you can take two ways, you'll take it the bad way against them. Now, I don't know why it's that way, but here that happened with David. The more he was down, the more he was put down, the more people slandered against him. I've heard the slander of many. Fear was on every side. While they took counsel together against me, they devised to take away my nephesh. Now, how could they do that if it's immortal? If it's something that goes to heaven and belongs to God? Here they're devising to take away your soul. So there are many good verses on soul all the way through the Psalms. But I trusted in you, O Eternal. I said, you're my God. My times are in your hand. Deliver me from the hand of mine enemies and from them that persecute me. So, you know, David said, God, you know when I need ups and downs. The word times here doesn't just mean how long I live, but it means the bad times and good times and all the times I go through, the different kinds of times you go through in your life, fears, testings, rejoicings, your times. David said, my times are in your hand, not my time, singular. He isn't talking about how long he lives. That's a part of it, of course. Deliver me from the hand of mine enemies and from them that persecute me. Make your face to shine upon your servant. Now you notice always, instead of saying smile to God, it's always light up. Make your face shine, radiate, give forth glory. So God doesn't smile, God radiates glory, just beams. Make your face to shine upon your servant. Save me for your mercy's sake. Since you want to be known as a merciful God, you want to be known as a God of patience and long-suffering and loving-kindness, and for that purpose, God, save me. Let me not be ashamed, O Eternal, because I've called upon you. Everybody knows there's that king. He's trusting in that God he's got, and now let's see what happens. Let the lawless, Rasha, the rebels, be ashamed. Let them be silent in the grave. Now, that's not suggesting others aren't silent in the grave. It's just saying, in a sense, that they don't have any justification, they don't have any excuses. When they're in the grave, they can't claim injustice or being misjudged or that they don't deserve it. So in the Old Testament even, it's as if the dead can speak from the grave like Lazarus did in the New Testament. Let the lying lips be put to silence, which speak grievous things proudly and contemptuously against the righteous. So here's again and again that happening where when somebody was down, boy, the thing to do was just really lay it on them, you know. So here he had grievous things that were proudly spoken against him, contemptuously against the man who'd been the great king. Oh, how great is your goodness, which you've laid up for them that fear you. Here brings in another important attitude toward God, a reverence toward God, an awe toward God, a fear toward God. Never like God's in your hip pocket and God is just your local God and your buddy-buddy God. And you know, that's, I see people abbreviate the name Jesus Christ. They put JC. I would never do that. You know, to me, I wouldn't even write his name in small letters. In fact, some people won't even write him and his and them, you know, when it's talking to God. They put it all capital letters. But I'd be real careful about getting too familiar with God in the sense that God is just a everyday God and kind of a God in your hip pocket, and he saved the parking spot for you down at the mall, and you know, he had somebody open the door for you, and no, he didn't do all that. He figures you can open your own door, you know, and find your own parking place. So don't try to make God a God of trivia or an everyday hip pocket God. There always has to be a fear of God. Now, parents ought to be that way. You know, the children ought to have a fear of their parents, but it shouldn't be a horror. It shouldn't be a dread. It shouldn't be a terror. But it shouldn't be buddy-buddy to the wrong extreme either. Going on anyway, how great is your goodness, which you've laid up for them that fear you, which you have wrought for them that trust in you, before the sons of men, the sons of Adam, you shall hide them in the secret of your presence from the pride of Enosh, or Ish, the other word for men here. You shall keep them secretly in a pavilion, or a tabernacle, from the strife of tongues. Blessed be the Eternal, for he has showed me his marvelous kindness in a strong city. So now apparently he's going back to Psalm 30 and talking about how God had given him Zion as his strong city and how God had made his city strong. And so now he's remembering how God showed him his marvelous kindness by giving him this strong city, by letting him be in his tabernacle. For I said in my haste, I'm cut off from before your eyes. So apparently this happened at the same time as these previous Psalms, and David had that attitude of death. It's too late. I've gone too far. My nephesh is about in Sheol. I'm about to go to destruction and corruption. So it was just, he gave up a little bit too soon, or thought maybe that was it. God was through with him. I said in my haste, I'm cut off from before your eyes. Nevertheless, you heard the voice of my supplications. Notice how key that word always is. You'll find that over and over again. When someone back in Hannah's days or Rachel's days, you know, and they supplicated God, and he intervened and gave them a child by promise. You find the Apostle Paul supplicating God, but it's always key times. You'll never find the word supplication associated with routine. Never associated with just generality or a daily type prayer. I mean, in a passing light prayer. You hear the voice of my supplications when I cried to you. Oh, love the Eternal, all you his saints, graced ones. Isn't that odd? They teach there's no grace in the Old Testament, and yet in some of the places the word saint means graced ones, as it does here. Favored or graced ones. For the Eternal preserves the faithful and plentifully rewards the proud doer. Be of good courage, and he'll strengthen your heart. Now, we've already read that. These psalms are all brother psalms. They're all tied right into the same group of psalms. They're all by David. Be of good courage, and he'll strengthen your heart. All you that hope in the Eternal, and there again is the same term, wait for. The word hope in, if you just wait on the Eternal, like he told you back in last part of one of the psalms we just finished,